You ever notice how some people just flat refuse to die? I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hanger on Radio Hanger. Pull up a chair because the story I want to tell you today is about a man who cheated death so many times that death eventually just stopped trying. Eddie Rickenbacker. If you only know one thing about him, it's probably that he was America's top ace in the First World War. 26 confirmed victories, Medal of Honor. The whole deal, but the part of his life that gets me, the part that I think about when I'm flying over open water, happened 24 years later, in October of 1942, on a life raft in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me back up. Because you need to understand who this man was before he ever climbed into a cockpit. Eddie Rickenbacker grew up dirt poor in Columbus, Ohio. His father was a Swiss immigrant who worked construction. Eddie dropped out of school at 13 when his father died, and he went to work in a glass factory, then a steel mill, then a machine shop. By the time he was in his early 20s, he was one of the most famous race car drivers in America. He raced in the Indianapolis 500. He was hitting speeds of over 100 miles an hour on dirt tracks with no seatbelt, no roll cage, nothing but a leather helmet and nerve. When America entered the First World War, Rickenbacker was 26 years old. He went to France as a staff driver, chauffeuring generals around, but he wanted to fly. The problem was the army didn't think a race car driver was officer material. He was too old, too uneducated, too rough around the edges, but Eddie Rickenbacker had a gift for engines. He understood machines the way some people understand music. He could hear a motor running and tell you which cylinder was misfiring. Eventually, he talked his way into flight training, and they assigned him to the 94th Aero Pursuit Squadron, the Hat in the Ring Squadron. Now here's where it gets interesting. Rickenbacker didn't score his first kill until March of 1918. He was a late starter compared to some of the other aces. But once he got going, he was relentless. He flew a SPAD 13, a French-built fighter with a 220-horsepower Hispano-Suiza engine. Not the fastest thing in the sky, not the most maneuverable, but solid, reliable. And Rickenbacker flew it like he drove race cars. He was calculating, patient, and absolutely fearless. He had this philosophy. He said, "You never attack unless you have the advantage. You climb above your opponent, you get the sun behind you, and you dive. One pass, one burst, and you're gone." He wasn't a wild dogfighter. He was a hunter. And in the span of about 7 months, he shot down 26 enemy aircraft, including 4 observation balloons, which were among the most dangerous targets on the Western Front because the Germans surrounded them with anti-aircraft guns. By November of 1918, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker was America's ace of aces. He was awarded the Medal of Honor, though it wasn't actually presented to him until 1930 because the original paperwork got lost in the War Department bureaucracy. Imagine that. You shoot down 26 enemy planes and they lose your Medal of Honor paperwork. After the war, Rickenbacker went into business. He bought the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He became president of Eastern Airlines and turned it into one of the most successful carriers in the country. He was a titan, but flying was never far from his life, and in 1941, when the Second World War broke out, he went right back to work for the military. Not as a combat pilot. He was 51 years old by then, but as a special envoy, an inspector, a troubleshooter. Secretary of War Henry Stimson sent him around the world to visit air bases and boost morale and report back on conditions. And that's how Eddie Rickenbacker ended up on a B-17 in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on October 21, 1942. He was on a secret mission to deliver a message from Stimson to General Douglas MacArthur in the Southwest Pacific. The pilot was a young captain named William Cherry. They were flying a B-17D, and they were supposed to land at Canton Island, a tiny coral atoll roughly halfway between Hawaii and Australia. But the navigator made an error. The headwinds were worse than forecast, and they overshot the island. They never found it. They flew search patterns until the fuel ran out. Captain Cherry ditched the B-17 in the open Pacific. The landing was rough. The airplane broke apart on impact with the swells, but all 8 men aboard survived the crash. They scrambled into 3 small life rafts, lashed them together, and watched the only airplane for 1,000 miles sink beneath the waves. They had almost nothing, a few oranges, a small amount of chocolate. A couple of fishing lines with no bait, no fresh water, no flares, no radio that worked. And they were somewhere in the vast emptiness of the Central Pacific, hundreds of miles from the nearest land, with no one quite sure where to look for them. The first few days they rationed the oranges. Each man got a small piece once a day. The chocolate was gone almost immediately. By the third or fourth day, the food was gone entirely. The sun was brutal. It beat down on them from sunrise to sunset with no shade, no shelter, nothing but the thin rubber walls of those rafts. At night, the temperature dropped and the men shivered in their wet clothes. The salt water caused sores on their skin that became infected. By the end of the first week, several of the men were delirious. They were sunburned so badly their skin was peeling off in sheets, their lips were cracked and bleeding, their tongues were swollen from dehydration. One man, Sergeant Alex Kaczmarczyk, was already gravely ill. He had been sick before the flight, and the exposure was destroying him. And then on the eighth day, something happened that Rickenbacker talked about for the rest of his life. He was sitting in the raft, his hat pulled down over his face, trying to stay still to conserve energy, and he felt something land on his head. He didn't move, he barely breathed. He waited. And then very slowly he reached up and grabbed a sea swallow, a small seabird that had landed on his head. He wrung its neck and they divided it among the eight men. It was barely a mouthful each, but they used the intestines as bait on the fishing lines, and that afternoon they caught two small fish. It wasn't much, but it was enough to keep them alive for another day. Rain came intermittently. They caught what they could in their shirts and the folds of the rafts, squeezing the fabric into their mouths for a few drops of fresh water. Some days they got nothing. Other days a brief squall would pass over and they would open their mouths to the sky like baby birds. On the 13th day, Sergeant Kaczmarczyk died. They said a prayer and slipped his body into the ocean. Rickenbacker later said that was the hardest moment, not because death was a surprise, but because every man in those rafts knew he could be next. The men began to argue about whether to stay together or separate the rafts to cover more area. Rickenbacker, who was the oldest man in the group by 20 years, held them together. Not gently either. He was, by his own admission and by the accounts of every man who survived, absolutely insufferable. He cursed at them, he goaded them, he told them they were quitters, he picked fights, the other men hated him for it, and years later, every single one of them said he saved their lives, because the anger kept them awake. It kept them fighting. A man who is furious at Eddie Rickenbacker is not a man who has given up. On the 14th day, they caught a small shark. On the 16th day, another rain squall. On the 17th day, they finally agreed to separate the rafts. Captain Cherry and one other man drifted away to the northwest. Another group headed south. Rickenbacker and two others stayed where they were. On the 20th day, a Navy patrol plane spotted Captain Cherry's raft. He was pulled from the water barely alive. He told the rescuers there were more men out there. Search planes fanned out across the Pacific. On the 21st day, they found the second raft. And on the 24th day, November 13, 1942, a Navy Kingfisher float plane spotted Rickenbacker's raft. The pilot, a young lieutenant, landed on the open ocean, taxied up to the raft, and pulled Rickenbacker and his two companions out of the water. Eddie Rickenbacker had been adrift for 24 days. He had lost almost 70 pounds. He was covered in salt sores and sunburn. His eyes were nearly swollen shut. And when they got him to the hospital at Funafuti, the doctors said he was in the worst physical condition of any man they had ever seen who was still breathing. 2 weeks later, he was back on his feet. He completed his mission, delivered the message to MacArthur, and spent the next several months touring Pacific air bases, telling combat crews the same thing he had told the men in those rafts. You do not quit. You do not give up. You keep fighting even when every rational thought tells you it's over.
Now, I should mention this wasn't even Rickenbacker's closest brush with death. In February of 1941, before the war, he had been a passenger on an Eastern Airlines DC-3 that crashed on approach to Atlanta. The airplane hit trees short of the runway. Rickenbacker was pinned in the wreckage with a crushed pelvis, broken ribs, a shattered elbow, and a punctured lung. A dead man was lying on top of him. Rescuers thought Rickenbacker was dead too, until someone noticed he was still breathing. He spent months in the hospital and walked with a limp for the rest of his life. So when people ask me what made Rickenbacker special, I don't start with the 26 aerial victories, I don't start with the Medal of Honor. I start with the fact that this man survived a car racing career, where drivers died regularly, survived the Western Front, survived a catastrophic airline crash, survived 24 days on a raft in the Pacific, and still had enough fight left in him to run an airline and live to be 82 years old. He died in Zurich, Switzerland, on July 23, 1973, peacefully in a hospital bed, which, if you think about it, might be the most surprising thing he ever did.
The details of the Pacific raft ordeal come from Rickenbacker's own memoir, published in 1967, and from W.L. White's earlier account written shortly after the rescue. If Rickenbacker's story doesn't make you sit a little straighter in the left seat, I don't know what will. More at RadioHangar.com. Fly safe out there.